continued, he picked out the leading men of both communities and sent them as ambassadors to Nero to argue the merits of the case. Chapter 8. Florus and Agrippa II. The next procurator, Festus, tackled the chief curse of the country. He killed a considerable number of the bandits and captured many more. Albinus, who followed him, acted very differently, being guilty of every possible misdemeanor. Not content with official actions that meant widespread robbery and looting of private property, or with taxes that crippled the whole nation, he allowed those imprisoned for banditry by local courts or his own predecessors to be bought out by their relatives, and only the man who failed to pay was left in jail to serve his sentence. Now, too, the revolutionary party in Jerusalem cast off all restraint, and its leaders bribed Albinus to shut his eyes to their subversive activities, whilst any of the common people who did not care for peace and quiet joined forces with the procurator's associates. Every scoundrel, surrounded by his own gang, stood out from his followers like a bandit chief or dictator, and used his henchmen to rob respectable citizens. The result was that the victims kept their wrongs to themselves, while those still immune, through fear of the same fate, flattered those they should have battered. In short, free speech was completely suppressed, and tyranny reigned everywhere. From then on, the seeds of the coming destruction were being sown in the city. Such a man was Albinus, but his successor, Gessius Florus, made him appear an angel by comparison. Albinus, for the most part, did his mischief with secrecy and dissimulation. Gessius boasted of the wrongs he did to the nation, and, as if sent as public executioner to punish condemned criminals, indulged in every kind of robbery and violence. When pitiable things happened, he showed himself the most heartless of men. When disgraceful things, the most disgusting. No one ever had less use for truth or thought out more subtle methods of crime. Making a profit out of individuals he considered poor sport, he stripped whole cities, ruined complete communities, and virtually announced to the entire country that everyone might be a bandit if he chose, so long as he himself received a rake-off. The result of his avarice was that every district was denuded, and many people left their old homes and fled to foreign provinces. As long as Cestius Gallus administered the province from his headquarters in Syria, no one dared even to inform against Florus. But when he appeared in Jerusalem on the eve of the Passover, the people crowded round, at least 3 million of them, imploring him to pity the nation in its distress and shouting against Florus, the ruin of their country. Florus, who was present and stood at Cestius's side, laughed at their protests. Cestius, however, quieted the excited crowd by assuring them that he would guarantee more reasonable conduct on Florus's part in the future. Then he returned to Antioch, but Florus accompanied him as far as Caesarea, disguising the intention he had already formed of making war on the nation, his only hope of diverting attention from his own crimes. For if peace lasted, he foresaw that he would have the Jews accusing him to Caesar. But if he contrived to make them revolt, the greater outrage would forestall any inquiry into lesser ones. So to ensure a nationwide revolt, he daily added to the general distress. Meanwhile, the Greeks of Caesarea secured from Nero control of the city, and returned with the decision in writing. War broke out in the 12th year of Nero's reign, and the 17th of Agrippa's, in the month of May. In comparison with the fearful disasters to which it led, its pretext was insignificant. the Jews in Caesarea had a synagogue alongside a piece of ground belonging to a Greek citizen. This they had repeatedly tried to acquire, offering many times the real value. Scorning their requests, the Greek further insulted them by beginning to build a factory right up to the dividing line, leaving them a narrow and utterly inadequate passage. The immediate result was that the more hot-headed of the young men jumped in and interfered with the builders. When this display of force was suppressed by Florus, the leading Jews, among them John the tax collector, having no other way out, gave Florus a bribe of 8 silver talents to put a stop to the work. As nothing mattered to him but money, he promised full cooperation. But as soon as the money was his, he left Caesarea for Sebaste, allowing party strife to take its course as if he had sold the Jews permission to fight it out. The next day was a Sabbath, and when the Jews gathered in the synagogue, a Caesarean partisan had placed a large earthen vessel upside down at the entrance and was sacrificing birds on it. This infuriated the Jews, who felt that their law had been violated and the site desecrated. The steadier, gentler people advised an appeal to the authorities. The quarrelsome element and youthful hotheads burned for a fight. The Caesarean partisans stood waiting for them, for they had sent the men to sacrifice by prearrangement, and the clash soon came. Jucundus, the cavalry officer detailed to prevent it, stepped forward, picked up the vessel, and attempted to end the strife. But he was no match for the violence of the Caesareans, so the Jews seized their law book and retired to Narbata, a Jewish area 7 miles from Caesarea. John and 12 other influential citizens followed Florus to Sebaste, where they complained bitterly of what had happened and implored him to help, tactfully reminding him of the 8 talents. He actually arrested these men and put them in prison on the ground that they had removed the law book from Caesarea. This new outrage caused anger in Jerusalem, but passions were still kept under control. Florus, however, as if he had contracted to fan the war into flame, sent to the temple treasury and removed 17 talents on the pretext that Caesar required it. Uproar followed at once, and the people rushed in a body into the temple, where with piercing yells they called on the name of Caesar, imploring him to free them from Florus's misrule. Some of the rioters shouted the most scandalous abuse at the latter, and going round with a hat begged coppers for the poor starveling. This did not cure his avarice, but increased his determination to get rich quick. So instead of going to Caesarea to extinguish the conflagration that was breaking out there, and to remove the causes of the trouble, as he had been paid to do, he dashed off to Jerusalem with an army of horse and foot, in order that, by Roman arms, he might get what he wanted, and by intimidation skin the city. The people, anxious to make him ashamed of his attempt, met the soldiers with friendly greetings, and prepared to receive Florus submissively. He, however, sent ahead 50 horsemen commanded by Capito, and ordered them to retire, and not to mock with newfound cordiality the man they had abused so scandalously. If they were fearless and outspoken, they ought to make fun of him to his face, and show by force of arms, as well as words, that they loved liberty. This took the crowd aback, and when Capito's troops charged into their midst, they scattered before they could salute Florus or convince the soldiers of their readiness to obey. Returning to their homes, they passed the night in fear and dejection. Florus slept in the palace, and the next day had a dais erected outside and took his seat. The chief priests, political leaders, and eminent citizens lined up before this tribunal. Florus ordered them to give up the men who had abused him, declaring that they themselves would feel the weight of his hand if the culprits were not forthcoming. The Jewish leaders insisted that the people were peacefully disposed and apologized for the offending remarks. In such a mass of people there were bound to be some impudent juveniles, and it was impossible to identify the miscreants when everyone was conscience-stricken and afraid to confess his guilt. if the procurator cared anything about the peaceful state of the nation and wished to save the city for the Romans, it would be better for the sake of the many innocent to pardon the few guilty than because of a few scamps to wreck the lives of so many loyal subjects. This plea made Florus still more furious, and he shouted to the soldiers to sack the upper marketplace and kill all they met. Their acquisitiveness, thus stimulated by their general's encouragement, they not only sacked the area to which they had been sent, but burst into all the houses and murdered the occupants. There followed a flight through the narrow streets, the slaughter of those who were caught and rapine in all its horror. Many peaceful citizens were seized and taken before Florus, who had them scourged and then crucified. The total number that perished that day, including women and children, for not even infants were spared, came to about 3,600. The disaster was made the more crushing by the unheard-of character of the Roman brutality. No one had ever before dared to do what Florus did then, to scourge men of equestrian rank before the judgment seat and nail them to the cross, men who were indeed Jews, but yet enjoyed Roman status. At this time it happened that King Agrippa had traveled to Alexandria to congratulate Alexander, who had been entrusted with Egypt by Nero, and sent there as governor. However, his sister Bernice was in Jerusalem, and seeing the criminal conduct of the soldiers, she was cut to the heart, and repeatedly sent her cavalry commanders and bodyguards to Florus to beg him to stop the slaughter. He, caring nothing for the number of victims or the high rank of the petitioner, but only for the profit he made out of the loot, was deaf to her appeals. And the mad fury of the soldiers did not even spare the queen. Not only did they torture their prisoners to death before her eyes, they would actually have killed her if she had not escaped in time into the royal palace and spent the night there with her guards, in fear that the soldiers would attack. She was staying in Jerusalem to perform a vow to God. It is usual for those who are sick or in distress to vow that for 30 days before they intend to sacrifice, they will abstain from wine and shave their heads. These vows Bernice was then performing, and she stood barefoot before the judgment seat appealing to Florus, but no respect was paid to her, and she went in danger of her life. These events occurred on the 16th of Artemisius. The next day the crowd, in great distress, swarmed into the upper marketplace, shrieking and lamenting for the dead, and still more vociferously calling down curses on Florus. This alarmed the influential citizens and chief priests, who rent their clothes and, falling down before one man after another, begged them to desist and not, after all they had suffered, provoke Florus to commit some irreparable outrage. The crowd at once complied out of respect for the petitioners and in the hope that Florus would commit no more crimes against them. The extinction of the disturbance annoyed the procurator, who, in order to rekindle the flames, summoned the chief priests and prominent citizens, and said that the only way of proving that the people would not revolt again was to go out and meet the troops approaching from Caesarea. Two cohorts were on the way. While the people were still being collected, he sent orders to the centurions of the cohorts to instruct their men not to return the Jews' salutes, and if they uttered a word against him, to use their weapons. The chief priests assembled great numbers in the temple and urged them to meet the Romans and to avert irreparable disaster by welcoming the cohorts. This appeal failed to influence the insurgent element, and the thought of the fallen swung the majority to the side of the bolder spirits. Thereupon every priest and every minister of God brought out the sacred vessels and put on the robes they always wore when officiating. The harpers and singers appeared with their instruments, and they all fell down and implored the people to preserve their sacred ornaments and not provoke the Romans to plunder the treasures of God. The chief priests themselves could be seen heaping dust on their heads, their clothes rent, and their breasts bared. They appealed by name to each of the prominent citizens, and collectively to the crowd, not by some trifling offence to betray their country to men who were anxious to sack it. What advantage would it be to the soldiers to be saluted by the Jews? What compensation for past wrongs not to go out now? If they gave them the usual welcome, Florus would be deprived of all pretext of war, and they themselves would enjoy their country and immunity from further wrong. Again, to give way to a handful of insurgents, when, with their overwhelming numbers, they could compel even them to behave sensibly, would be feeble in the extreme. With these arguments, they quietened the crowd, while the insurgents yielded, some to threats, others to authority. Then, leading the way, they went quietly and in good order to meet the column, and, when the soldiers came near, saluted them. But when they met with no response, they began to vilify Florus. This was the agreed signal to attack them. In a flash, the soldiers had surrounded and begun to club them. When they fled, the cavalry pursued them and trampled them down. Many fell under the blows of the Romans. More were crushed by their friends. Round the gates there was frightful congestion. As everyone raced to get in first, the flight was slowed down for them all, and those who stumbled met a horrible end. Suffocated and crushed to pulp beneath countless feet, they were unrecognizable when their kinsfolk came to bury them. The soldiers poured in with the fugitives, raining blows on any they caught, and drove the crowd through Bezetha in an effort to force their way through and seize the temple and Antonia. For the same purpose, Florus led his own men out of the royal palace and endeavored to reach the fortress, but the attempt failed, for the people swung round to face him and blocked his advance, then lined up on the roofs and pelted the Romans. Suffering severely from the falling missiles and too weak to hack a way through the crowds that blocked the narrow streets, they retreated to their camp near the palace. The insurgents, afraid that Florus would come on again and seize the temple by way of Antonia, climbed up at once and cut a gap in the colonnades that linked Antonia with the temple. This cooled the avarice of Florus, for it was the treasures of God he was after, and for this reason he was anxious to get into Antonia, so that when the colonnades were broken down, he was diverted from his attempt. He sent for the chief priests and the Sanhedrin, and told them that he was going to quit the city, but would leave them as big a garrison as they wanted. In reply, they solemnly promised to maintain order and prevent any rising if he left them one cohort, but not the one that had been engaged, as the people hated it because of what it had done to them. So he changed the cohort as requested, and with the rest of his forces went back to Caesarea. As a further inducement to hostilities, he sent Cestius a false report of a Jewish revolt, alleging that they had started the recent fighting, and charging them with violence of which they had in reality been the victims. The Jerusalem magistrates did not take this lying down. They, and Bernice too, wrote more than one letter to Cestius about the crimes which Florus had committed against the city. Cestius read the communications from both parties and consulted his staff. They advised him to go at once to Jerusalem at the head of an army, and either punish the revolt, if real, or strengthen the allegiance of the Jews, if they were indeed loyal. But he thought it better to send one of his colleagues first to examine the position and to bring a reliable report of the state of Jewish feeling. So he sent the tribune, Neapolitanus, who at Jamnia met King Agrippa on his way home from Alexandria and told him who had sent him and why. There, too, the Jews' chief priests, with influential citizens and the Sanhedrin, arrived to welcome the king. After paying homage, they began to bewail their own calamities and to describe the savagery of Florus. This shocked Agrippa, but he discreetly turned his indignation on the Jews he inwardly pitied, wishing to humble their pride, and by refusing to see that they had suffered any wrong, to damp their ardor for revenge. They, being men of parts and property owners with a personal interest in peace, realized that the king's rebuke was kindly meant. But the people came 7 miles out of Jerusalem to welcome Agrippa and Neoplatonus, with the widows of the slain running in front and wailing, and the people replying to their groans with lamentations. They implored Agrippa to help them, and dinned into the ears of Neoplatonus all that Florus had done to them. When they entered the city, the Jews pointed to the desolate marketplace and sacked houses. Then, with Agrippa's help, they persuaded Neoplatonus, with one attendant, to walk round the city as far as Siloam, and see for himself that the Jews were submissive to all other Romans, and only bitter against Florus because of his appalling savagery. Going through the city, Neoplatonus found proof enough of their docility, so he went up into the temple. There he assembled the people, praised them highly for their loyalty to Rome, and urged them strongly to keep the peace. Then from the outer court he made obeisance to the sanctuary of God, after which he returned to Cestius. The Jewish crowd now turned to the king and the chief priests, begging them to send envoys to Nero to denounce Florus, and by protesting against his wholesale massacres to end suspicions of a Jewish revolt, for they would be thought to have started hostilities if they were not quick to point out the real aggressor. It was evident that they would not take it quietly if anyone tried to block the embassy. Agrippa realized that to choose men to accuse Florus would be to ask for trouble, but that to stand by till Jewish fury flared up into actual hostilities was dangerous even for himself. So he summoned the crowd into the gymnasium and placed his sister Bernice conspicuously on the roof of the Hasmonean palace. This was above the gymnasium on the other side of the upper city. The gymnasium was linked with the temple by a bridge. Then he began. If I had found you all eager for war with the Romans, whereas, in fact, the most honest and sincere section of the people are bent on keeping the peace, I should not have come forward to address you or ventured to give advice, for it is a waste of breath to say anything in favor of a wise course when the audience is unanimously in favor of a foolish one. But some of you are young men, with no experience of the horrors of war. Others are too sanguine about the prospects of independence. Others are led on by selfish ambition and the profit to be made out of weaker men if the explosion occurs. So in the hope that these men may learn sense and change their ways, and that the folly of a few may not be visited on good citizens, I felt obliged to call you all together and tell you what I think is best. Please do not interrupt me if you disapprove of what I say, for those who have absolutely made up their mind to revolt will be free to feel the same after hearing my views. But my words will be lost even on those who want to listen unless everyone keeps quiet. Now, I am aware that many speak against the insolence of the procurators and rhapsodize about the wonders of liberty. But before I go into the question of who you are and whom you are planning to fight, I must first sort out your jumble of pretexts. If you are trying to avenge your wrongs, why do you prat about liberty? If, on the other hand, slavery seems unbearable, it is a waste of time to blame your rulers. If they were the mildest of men, it would still be disgraceful to be slaves. Consider these pretexts one at a time, and see how feeble are your grounds for war. First, the charges against the procurators. You should flatter, not provoke, the authorities. When for trifling errors you pile on reproaches, it is yourselves you hurt by your denunciation of the offenders. Instead of injuring you secretly and shamefacedly, they plunder you openly. Nothing damps an aggressor like patient submission, and the meekness of the persecuted puts the persecutor to shame. I grant that the ministers of Rome are unbearably harsh. Does it follow that all the Romans are persecuting you, including Caesar? Yet it is on them that you are going to make war. It is not by their wish that an unscrupulous governor comes from Rome, nor can Western eyes see the goings-on in the East. It is not easy in Rome even to get up-to-date news of what happens here. It would be absurd, because of the trifling misdemeanors of one man, to go to war with a whole nation, and such a nation. A nation that does not even know what it is all about. Our grievances can be quickly put right. The same procurator will not be here forever, and his successors are almost sure to be more reasonable. But once set on foot, war cannot easily be either broken off or fought to a conclusion without disaster. As for your new passion for liberty, it comes too late. You ought to have made a supreme effort to retain it long ago, for the experience of slavery is a painful one, and to escape it altogether any effort is justified. But the man who has once submitted and then revolts is a refractory slave, not a lover of liberty. Thus the time when we ought to have done everything possible to keep the Romans out was when the country was invaded by Pompey. But our ancestors and their kings, with material, physical, and mental resources far superior to yours, faced a mere fraction of the Roman army and put up no resistance. Will you, who have learnt submission from your fathers, and are so ill-provided compared with those who first submitted, stand up to the whole Roman Empire? Think of the Athenians. To preserve the liberty of Greece, they once consigned their city to the flames. When proud Xerxes sailed across land and marched across water, and counting the seas no barrier, led an army too big for Europe to hold, they chased him away in a single ship like a runaway slave. Near Little Salamis, they broke the might of Asia, and today they are slaves of Rome, and the city that once lorded it over Greece takes her orders from Italy. Think of the Spartans, after Thermopylae and Plataea, after Agesilaus, who swept across Asia. They are happy under the same masters. Think of the Macedonians. They still dream of Philip and see visions of the goddess who, with Alexander, sowed for them the seeds of world empire. Yet they endure this complete transformation and loyally serve the new recipients of fortune's favors. Other nations by the thousand, bursting with greater determination to assert their liberty, no longer resist. Will you alone refuse to serve the masters of the whole world? Where are the men? Where are the weapons you count on? Where is the fleet that is to sweep the Roman seas? Where are the funds to pay for your expeditions? Do you think you are going to war with Egyptians and Arabs? Look at the far-flung empire of Rome and contrast your own impotence. Why, our forces have been worsted even by our neighbors again and again, while their arms have triumphed over the whole world. And even the world is not big enough to satisfy them. Euphrates is not far enough to the east, or Danube to the north, or Libya and the desert beyond to the south, or Cadiz to the west. But beyond the ocean they have sought a new world, carrying their arms as far as Britain, that land of mystery. Why not face facts? Are you richer than the Gauls, stronger than the Germans, cleverer than the Greeks, more numerous than all the nations of the world? What gives you confidence to defy the power of Rome? It is terrible to be enslaved, it will be said. How much worse for Greeks, who surpass every nation under the sun in nobility, and fill such a wide domain, and yet bow before the fasces of a Roman governor, as do the Macedonians, who have a better right than you to demand their liberty. And what of the 500 cities of Asia? Do they not, without a garrison, bow before one governor and the consular fasces? Need I mention the Heniochi, the Colchians, and the Tauric race, the peoples near the Bosporus, the Black Sea, and the Sea of Azov? At one time they recognized not even a native ruler. And now they submit to 3,000 legionaries, while 40 warships keep the peace on the sea where before none but pirates sailed. Aljustly, Bithynia, Cappadocia, Pamphylia, Lycia, and Cilicia might demand liberty. Yet without armed pressure, they pay their dues. Then there are the Thracians, spread over a country 5 days' march in width and 7 in length, more rugged and much more defensible than yours, a country whose icy blasts are enough to halt an invader. Yet 2,000 Roman guards suffice to maintain order. Their neighbors, the Illyrians, whose land extends from Dalmatia to the Danube frontier, need only 2 legions to keep them quiet. In fact, Illyrians unite with Romans to halt Dacian raids. The Dalmatians, again, who have so often tried to shake off the yoke and have always been driven by defeat to rally their forces and revolt again, now live peaceably under 1 Roman legion. But if any people might reasonably be tempted to rebel by its peculiar advantages, that people is the Gauls, provided as they are with such marvelous natural defenses, on the east, the Alps, on the north, the Rhine, on the south, the Pyrenees, on the west, the ocean. Yet in spite of these immense obstacles, in spite of the huge total of 305 nations, in spite of the prosperity that wells up from their soil and enables them to flood the whole world with their goods, they submit to being the milk cow of Rome and receiving from her hands what they themselves have produced. And this they tolerate, not from effeminacy or racial inferiority. They fought for 80 years to save their liberty, but because they are overawed by the might of Rome, and still more by her destiny, which wins her more victories than do her arms. So Gaul is kept in order by 1,200 soldiers, hardly more men than she has cities. Then Spain. In the fight for independence, the gold from her soil could not save her, nor could the vast stretch of land and sea that separates her from Rome, nor the tribes of Lusitania and Cantabria with their passion for fighting, nor the neighboring ocean that terrifies even the natives with its tides. Crossing the cloud-capped Pyrenees and advancing their arms beyond the Pillars of Hercules, the Romans enslaved Spain too. Yet to guard this remote and almost invincible nation requires but 1 legion. Which of you has not heard of the Germans with their inexhaustible manpower? You have, I am sure, seen their magnificent physique on many occasions, for on every side Roman masters have German slaves. Yet this people occupies an immense area. Their physique is surpassed by their pride. From the bottom of their hearts they despise death, and, when enraged, they are more dangerous than the fiercest of wild beasts. Yet the Rhine is the limit of their aggression, and the Romans with 8 legions have tamed them, enslaving the prisoners and driving the entire nation to seek refuge in flight. Consider the defenses of the Britons, you who feel so sure of the defenses of Jerusalem. They are surrounded by the ocean and inhabit an island as big as this continent. Yet the Romans crossed the sea and enslaved them, and 4 legions keep that huge island quiet. But why should I say more about that, when even the Parthians, the most warlike race of all, rulers of so many nations and protected by such vast forces, send hostages to Rome, and on Italian soil may be seen humbly submitting, for the sake of peace, the aristocrats of the East. Almost every nation under the sun bows down before the might of Rome. And will you alone go to war, not even considering the fate of the Carthaginians, who boasted of great Hannibal and their glorious Phoenician ancestors, but fell beneath Scipio's hand? The Cyrenians, Spartans by descent, the Marmaridae, a race that extends to the waterless desert, Syrtes, whose very mention terrifies, Nasamonians, Moors, Numidians with their vast numbers. None of them could resist Roman skill at arms. This third of the whole world, whose nations could hardly be counted, bounded by the Atlantic and the Pillars of Hercules, and supporting the millions of Ethiopia as far as the Indian Ocean, is subdued in its entirety. And apart from the regular crops, which for 8 months of the year feeds the whole population of Rome, these peoples pay tribute of every kind, and for the needs of the empire willingly submit to taxation. And unlike you, they take no offense when given orders, though only a single legion is quartered in their midst. But why should we go so far for evidence of the Roman power, when we can find it in Egypt, our nearest neighbor? She stretches as far as Ethiopia and Arabia Felix. She is the port for India. She has a population of 7,500,000, excluding the citizens of Alexandria, as is shown by the poll tax returns. But she does not repudiate the rule of Rome. Yet what a stimulus to revolt she has in Alexandria, with its size, its population, its wealth. A city 3.5 miles long and over 1 mile wide, which pays Rome every month more tribute than you pay in a year, and apart from money sends her corn for 4 months, and which is protected on every side by trackless deserts or harbourless seas or rivers or marshes. Yet none of these things proved equal to the fortune of Rome, and 2 legions stationed in the city curb the remotest parts of Egypt and the nobility of Macedon as well. Whom, I ask you, will you find in the uninhabited wilds to be your allies in this war? For in the inhabited world all are Romans, unless you extend your hopes beyond the Euphrates and imagine that your kinsmen even beyond the Tigris will come to your aid. But they will not, without good reason, get involved in a full-scale war. And if they should decide on anything so foolish, the Parthian king would put a stop to it. For he is anxious to preserve his armistice with the Romans, and will consider it a breach of the truce if any of his tributaries takes the field against them. So there is no refuge left, except to make God your ally. But he too is ranged on the Roman side, for without his help so vast an empire could never have been built up. Think, too, how difficult it would be, even if you were fighting feeble opponents, to preserve the purity of your religion, and how you will be forced to transgress the very laws which furnish your chief hope of making God your ally, and so will alienate him. If you observe the custom of the Sabbath with its complete cessation of activity, you will promptly be crushed, as were your ancestors by Pompey, who was most active in pressing the siege on the days when the besieged were passive. But if in the war you transgress your ancestral law, I don't see what you have left to fight for, since your one desire is that none of your ancestral customs should be broken. How will you be able to call the deity to your aid if you deliberately deny him the service that is due? Everyone who engages in war relies on either divine or human help, but when, as is probable, both are denied, the aggressor is bringing certain destruction on himself. What prevents you from killing your wives and children with your own hands, and from consigning your ancestral home, the most beautiful in the world, to the flames? By such madness you will at least avoid the shame of defeat. It is wise, my friends, it is wise, while the vessel is still in harbor, to foresee the approaching storm, and not to sail out into the middle of the hurricane to sure destruction. For those on whom disaster falls out of the blue are at least entitled to pity. But a man who plunges into destruction with his eyes open earns only contempt. Possibly some of you suppose that you are making war in accordance with agreed rules, and that when the Romans have won, they will be kind to you, and will not think of making you an example to other nations by burning down your holy city and destroying your entire race. I tell you, Not even if you survive will you find a place of refuge, since every people recognizes the lordship of Rome or fears that it will have to do so. Again, the danger threatens not only ourselves here, but also those who live in other cities, for there is not a region in the world without its Jewish colony. All these, if you go to war, will be massacred by your opponents, and through the folly of a few men every city will run with Jewish blood. There would be an excuse for such a massacre, but if it did not take place, think how wicked it would be to take up arms against such kindly people. Pity your wives and children, or at least pity your mother city and its sacred precincts. Spare the temple and preserve for your use the sanctuary with its sacred treasures. For the Romans will no longer keep their hands off when they have captured these, since for sparing them hitherto they have received no thanks at all. I call to witness all you hold sacred, the holy angels of God and the fatherland we all share, that I have not kept back anything that is for your safety. If you make a right decision, you will share with me the blessings of peace. But if you are carried away by your passions, you will go without me to your doom." At the end of his speech, he burst into tears, as did his sister, and with his tears considerably damped the ardor of his hearers. But they shouted that it was not Rome they were fighting. It was Florus, the man who had done them such wrong. To this King Agrippa replied, "But you have acted as if you were already at war with Rome. You have paid no tribute to Caesar, and you have cut down the colonnades leading to Antonia. You can refute the charges of insurrection by joining up the colonnades again and paying the tax. For, you know, Florus doesn't own the fortress, and Florus will not receive your money." Accepting this advice, the people, with the king and Bernice, went up into the temple and began to rebuild the colonnades, while the magistrates and counselors went to the various villages and collected the tribute, quickly getting together the 40 talents due. In this way Agrippa delayed, for the moment, the threatened war. But when he tried further to persuade the mob to obey Florus until Caesar sent a successor to replace him, they were furious and abused the king and announced his banishment from the city. Some of the insurgents even dared to throw stones at him. The king saw that the passions of the revolutionaries could no longer be controlled, and wounded by the insults he had received, he sent their magistrates and influential citizens to Florus.